As Laurie spoke, he delivered a brown paper parcel to Meg, pulled Beth's hair ribbon, stared at Joe's big pinafore, and fell into an attitude of mock rapture before Amy. Then shook hands all round, and everyone began to talk. "Where is John?" asked Meg anxiously. "Stop to get the license for tomorrow, ma'am." "Which side won the last match, Teddy?" inquired Joe, who persisted in feeling an interest in manly sports despite her 19 years. "Ours, of course. Wish you'd been there to see." "How is the lovely Miss Randall?" asked Amy, with a significant smile. "More cruel than ever. Don't you see how I'm pining away?" And Laurie gave his broad chest a sounding slap and heaved a melodramatic sigh. "What's the last joke? Undo the bundle and see, Meg," said Beth, eyeing the knobby parcel with curiosity. "It's a useful thing to have in the house in case of fire or thieves," observed Laurie, as a watchman's rattle appeared amid the laughter of the girls. "Any time when John is away and you get frightened, Mrs. Meg, just swing that out the front window and it will rouse the neighborhood in a jiffy. Nice thing, isn't it?" And Laurie gave them a sample of its powers that made them cover up their ears. "There's gratitude for you. And speaking of gratitude, reminds me to mention that you may thank Hannah for saving your wedding cake from destruction. I saw it going into your house as I came by, and if she hadn't defended it manfully, I'd have had a pick at it, for it looked like a remarkably plummy one." "I wonder if you will ever grow up, Laurie," said Meg in a matronly tone.
"I'm doing my best, ma'am, but can't get much higher, I'm afraid, as 6 feet is about all men can do in these degenerate days," responded the young gentleman, whose head was about level with the little chandelier. "I suppose it would be profanation to eat anything in this spick-and-span new bower. So, as I'm tremendously hungry, I propose an adjournment," he added presently.
"Mother and I are going to wait for John. There are some last things to settle," said Meg, bustling away. "Beth and I are going over to Kitty Bryant's to get more flowers for tomorrow," added Amy, tying a picturesque hat over her picturesque curls and enjoying the effect as much as anybody.
"Come, Joe, don't desert a fellow. I'm in such a state of exhaustion I can't get home without help. Don't take off your apron, whatever you do. It's peculiarly becoming," said Laurie.
As Joe bestowed his especial aversion in her capacious pocket and offered him her arm to support his feeble steps.
"Now, Teddy, I want to talk seriously to you about tomorrow," began Joe, as they strolled away together. "You must promise to behave well, and not cut up any pranks and spoil our plans."
"Not a prank. And don't say funny things when we ought to be sober."
"I never do. You're the one for that. And I implore you not to look at me during the ceremony. I shall certainly laugh if you do."
"You won't see me. You'll be crying so hard that the thick fog round you will obscure the prospect."
"I never cry unless for some great affliction."
"Such as fellows going to college, eh?" cut in Laurie, with a suggestive laugh.
"Don't be a peacock. I only moaned a trifle to keep the girls company."
"Exactly. I say, Joe, how is Grandpa this week? Pretty amiable?"
"Very."
"Why, have you got into a scrape and want to know how he'll take it?" asked Joe, rather sharply.
"Now, Joe, do you think I'd look your mother in the face and say all right if it wasn't?"
And Laurie stopped short, with an injured air.
"No, I don't."
"Then don't go and be suspicious. I only want some money," said Laurie, walking on again, appeased by her hearty tone.
"You spend a great deal, Teddy."
"Bless you, I don't spend it. It spends itself somehow, and is gone before I know it."
"You are so generous and kind-hearted that you let people borrow and can't say no to anyone. We heard about Henshaw and all you did for him."
"If you always spent money in that way, no one would blame you," said Joe warmly.
"Oh, he made a mountain out of a molehill. You wouldn't have me let that fine fellow work himself to death just for the want of a little help, when he is worth a dozen of us lazy chaps, would you?"
"Of course not. But I don't see the use of your having 17 waistcoats, endless neckties, and a new hat every time you come home. I thought you'd got over the dandy period.
but every now and then it breaks out in a new spot. Just now it's the fashion to be hideous, to make your head look like a scrubbing brush, wear a straitjacket, orange gloves, and clumping square-toed boots. If it was cheap ugliness, I'd say nothing, but it costs as much as the other, and I don't get any satisfaction out of it. Laurie threw back his head and laughed so heartily at this attack that the felt basin fell off, and Joe walked on it, which insult only afforded him an opportunity for expatiating on the advantages of a rough-and-ready costume, as he folded up the maltreated hat and stuffed it into his pocket. "Don't lecture any more, there's a good soul. I have enough all through the week, and like to enjoy myself when I come home. I'll get myself up regardless of expense tomorrow and be a satisfaction to my friends. I'll leave you in peace if you'll only let your hair grow. I'm not aristocratic, but I do object to being seen with a person who looks like a young prize-fighter," observed Joe severely. "This unassuming style promotes study. That's why we adopt it," returned Laurie, who certainly could not be accused of vanity, having voluntarily sacrificed a handsome curly crop to the demand for a quarter of an inch long stubble. "By the way, Joe, I think that little Parker is really getting desperate about Amy. He talks of her constantly, writes poetry, and moons about in a most suspicious manner. He'd better nip his little passion in the bud, hadn't he?" added Laurie, in a confidential, elder-brotherly tone, after a minute's silence. "Of course he had. We don't want any more marrying in this family for years to come. Mercy on us, what are the children thinking of?" And Joe looked as much scandalized as if Amy and little Parker were not yet in their teens. "It's a fast age, and I don't know what we are coming to, ma'am. You were a mere infant, but you'll go next, Joe, and we'll be left lamenting," said Laurie, shaking his head over the degeneracy of the times. "Don't be alarmed. I'm not one of the agreeable sort. Nobody will want me, and it's a mercy, for there should always be one old maid in a family." "You won't give anyone a chance," said Laurie, with a sidelong glance, and a little more colour than before in his sunburned face. "You won't show the soft side of your character. And if a fellow gets a peep at it by accident and can't help showing that he likes it, you treat him as Mrs. Gummidge did her sweetheart. Throw cold water over him, and get so thorny no one dares touch or look at you. I don't like that sort of thing. I'm too busy to be worried with nonsense, and I think it's dreadful to break up families so. Don't say any more about it. Meg's wedding has turned all our heads, and we talk of nothing but lovers and such absurdities. I don't wish to get cross, so let's change the subject." And Joe looked quite ready to fling cold water on the slightest provocation. Whatever his feelings might have been, Laurie found a vent for them in a long, low whistle, and the fearful prediction as they parted at the gate. "Mark my words, Joe, you'll go next." Chapter 25. The First Wedding. The June roses over the porch were awake bright and early on that morning, rejoicing with all their hearts in the cloudless sunshine, like friendly little neighbours as they were. Quite flushed with excitement were their ruddy faces, as they swung in the wind, whispering to one another what they had seen, for some peeped in at the dining-room windows where the feast was spread. Some climbed up to nod and smile at the sisters as they dressed the bride. Others waved a welcome to those who came and went on various errands in garden, porch, and hall. And all, from the rosiest full-blown flower to the palest baby bud, offered their tribute of beauty and fragrance to the gentle mistress who had loved and tended them so long. Meg looked very like a rose herself, for all that was best and sweetest in heart and soul seemed to bloom into her face that day, making it fair and tender, with a charm more beautiful than beauty. Neither silk, lace, nor orange flowers would she have. "I don't want to look strange or fixed up today," she said. "I don't want a fashionable wedding, but only those about me whom I love, and to them I wish to look and be my familiar self." So she made her wedding gown herself, sewing into it the tender hopes and innocent romances of a girlish heart. Her sisters braided up her pretty hair,
and the only ornaments she wore were the lilies of the valley, which her John liked best of all the flowers that grew.